tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. The U.S. House of Representatives Monday passed the Electrify Africa Act after nearly 2 years of trying to get the measure through both chambers of Congress. It now goes to President Barack Obama for his signature. House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Ed Royce of California said the Electrify Africa Act seeks to address the massive electricity shortage that affects the everyday lives of millions of people.
It is a direct response to the fact that today 600 million people living in sub-Saharan Africa, that's 70% of the population, do not have access to reliable electricity.
The bill will provide a framework for a major public-private partnership between the United States and sub-Saharan African countries to help millions of people gain access to reliable electricity. The International Criminal Court said Tuesday it will deliver its verdict next month in the long-running trial of former Congolese Vice President Jean-Pierre Bemba, accused of militia war crimes in the Central African Republic over 14 years ago. His trial wrapped up in mid-November of 2014, and Tuesday, the court issued an order scheduling the hearing to deliver the verdict in the case on Monday, March 21st. Bemba is charged with 3 war crimes counts and 2 crimes against humanity committed by some 1,500 members of his private army. A Ugandan general arrested for criticizing President Yoweri Museveni and voicing support for the opposition was charged in a military court Tuesday and sent to a maximum security prison, according to his lawyer. Museveni aims to extend his 30-year rule and is facing perhaps his toughest challenge yet ahead of the election of February 18th. VOA News. North Korea notified UN agencies Tuesday that it plans to launch a satellite later this month, which could advance the isolated country's development of long-range missile technology. Pyongyang conducted its 4th nuclear test on January 6th in defiance of United Nations sanctions and last launched a long-range rocket in December 2012, sending an object it described as a communication satellite into orbit. Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department says any North Korea satellite launch would be egregious violation of its international obligations. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said Tuesday the international effort to defeat the Islamic State group is moving in the right direction, but he cautioned more must be done to support stabilization in Libya and Iraq. Kerry spoke at the opening of a ministerial meeting in Rome where representatives from about 20 countries came to talk about ways to boost the anti-Islamic State campaign. He highlighted the risk of the militants taking control in Libya with its vast oil resources. The UN Children's Fund says children and women, for the first time since the migrant crisis exploded in Europe, make up the majority of refugees and migrants on the move. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Barely 6 months ago, UNICEF reported men made up 73% of the migrant flow through Europe. Since then, it says there has been a major spike in the numbers of children and women on the move. They now account for 60% of the refugees and migrants crossing the Greek border into Macedonia. UNICEF says more children and women than before are dying while making the treacherous sea crossing between Turkey and Greece. The International Organization for Migration estimates 60 children under the age of 18 died during the past month on the so-called Eastern Mediterranean route, bringing the total number of minors who have drowned during the past 5 months to 330. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Red Cross has put out an emergency appeal for funding to help with the outbreak of the Zika virus, which could infect as many as 4 million people in the Americas this year. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies launched the appeal Tuesday for $2.3 million to support the regional response to the crisis. The virus is believed to be linked to microcephaly, which is a neurological disorder in which babies are born with abnormally small heads. Authorities in Afghanistan said Tuesday that airstrikes conducted with the support of the United States in a restive eastern region have destroyed an Islamic State radio station along with its internet communications and other facilities. The air raids also killed 29 IS fighters, including 5 staff of the so-called Voice of the Caliphate. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The World Health Organization warns of a potential surge of microcephaly, a neurological disorder in babies with possible links to the Zika virus, to Africa, Asia, and other areas of the world that lack the tools to tackle the disease.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from WHO headquarters in Geneva. Details coming up.
Also in the news, the Burundian government denies Amnesty International's allegations of three mass graves near Bujumbura. And elsewhere, Islamic State militants are said to be building an army of the poor in Libya, recruiting soldiers from Chad, Mali, and Sudan.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, and music, and our daily feature. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the Burundian government denies Amnesty International's allegations of three mass graves near Bujumbura and elsewhere. The rights group alleges the graves result from the ongoing violence in the country. The government released a statement today, but officials are expected to say more on the subject tonight on radio and TV. Hundreds have died since April after President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term in office. Critics called it unconstitutional and a violation of the Arusha peace accords for the country. Reporter Moses Havayarimana is following developments in the Burundi capital. He spoke to VOA's David Arnold about government reaction.
By the Amnesty International, there is a presence of mass graves in Burundi, in Bujumbura, ever since two military bases were attacked in December last year. Well, we understand that now the government of Burundi have come out and denied these allegations and said that these reports are not clear and they had their own propaganda of promoting the deployment of the peacekeeping mission in Burundi in the eve of the African Union Heads of State Summit, which took place in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. The Burundi government said that this is not the first time that the Amnesty International has released negative reports on the country.
The government thinks that the timing of the report coincides too closely with the African Union effort to send in peacekeepers. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly. However, the earlier on, the Parliament of Burundi had already rejected, and the government of Burundi had already rejected peacekeepers' mission to be deployed in the country, and concern said that this could be a violation of the national sovereignty, and if deployed without the government consent, it could be invasion in the country.
So if they're at an impasse in terms of the report and that the AU has decided not to send in peacekeepers, what is the state of the dialogue between the government and the opposition in Burundi now?
What we understand now currently is that most of the opposition political party leaders are outside the country who are very critical to the government, so they are not in the country. However, the National Dialogue Commission, which was formed by Burundi President Pierre, launched the national dialogue in the countryside in some provinces. But the chairman of the Dialogue Commission said that his commission cannot be able to go outside the country and bring the stakeholders to settle their political differences.
That was reporter Moses Havayarimana in Bujumbura. He spoke to VOA's David Arnold.
The London Telegraph is reporting that Islamic State militants are building what's called an army of the poor in Libya. The newspaper quotes Libyan intelligence sources as saying ISIS is recruiting soldiers from Africa's poorest countries. The group's Libyan chapter reportedly is offering $1,000 to each person who joins. That's equivalent to about 1 year's salary for many people. Recruitment is said to be going on in Chad, Mali, and Sudan. The Telegraph says it's the same strategy used by the late Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi when he recruited mercenaries from sub-Saharan Africa for his army. In other news on Libya, the African Union has appointed former Tanzanian President Jakaya Kikwete as its new special envoy to Libya. He succeeds Delita Mohamed Delita of Djibouti, who held the position since 2014. Libya has two rival governments, one in Tobruk and the other in Tripoli.
More than 40 jihadists have tried to enter Europe or actually managed to get in while posing as Syrian war refugees in the past 8 months. That's according to an international terrorism research consultancy. Weeding out terrorist operatives or returning European jihadists disguised as asylum seekers is likely to prove more challenging as refugee numbers start to climb when weather improves in the spring. The International Rescue Committee says in the first 3 weeks of January, 36,000 war refugees from the Mideast and mainly economic migrants from Africa entered Europe.
The World Health Organization warns of a potential surge of microcephaly, a neurological disorder in babies, with possible links to the Zika virus to Africa, Asia, and other areas of the world that lack the tools to tackle the disease. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization has declared the recent surge of microcephaly cases and other neurological disorders in Brazil a public health emergency of international concern because of its strong association with the Zika virus. The WHO reports that cases of microcephaly in newborn babies in Brazil have soared to nearly 4,200 between October and January, a tenfold increase over previous years. The abnormal neurological condition has now spread to 25 countries in Latin America. Although microcephaly is a relatively rare condition, the WHO says it is worried that the disease could spread to other areas of the world where populations may not be immune to the Zika virus. WHO Director of Maternal Health, Anthony Costello, says the mosquito that carries the Zika virus is present throughout Africa, in parts of Southern Europe, and many parts of Asia, particularly Southeast Asia. He says microcephaly is not a life-threatening illness like Ebola, but he notes complications that result from having a child with an abnormally small brain can have a potentially devastating impact on families.
To have a child with microcephaly and to have a tenfold increase in numbers and the potential for spread, not just across Latin America, but into Africa, into Asia, which have the highest birth rates in the world, we believe is a matter of public health concern and constitutes an international emergency. And particularly given that our tools for detecting both the virus and also for doing the surveillance for this relatively rare condition need to be worked on urgently.
To that end, the World Health Organization has set up a global response unit that brings together people with different necessary expertise at its headquarters and in regional centers. Dr. Costello says the response team will use all the lessons learned from the Ebola crisis. The WHO has been heavily criticized for responding too slowly to the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. By the time the WHO declared Ebola a global public health emergency, the virus was out of control and had killed thousands of its victims. The agency's swift response to the explosive Zika virus outbreak is an attempt to not be caught short again. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yais Wuhid, 14 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The Burundian government denies Amnesty International's allegations of three mass graves near Bujumbura and elsewhere. Islamic State militants are said to be building an army of the poor in Libya, recruiting soldiers from Chad, Mali, and Sudan. and more than 40 jihadists have tried to enter Europe while posing as Syrian war refugees in the past 8 months. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The African Union Peace and Security Council yesterday approved $250 million in military aid to fight Boko Haram rebels based in Nigeria. The rebels have in the past year stepped up cross-border attacks in Niger, Chad, and Cameroon, while continuing shooting and suicide assaults on markets, mosques, and other mostly civilian targets within Nigeria itself. Despite offensives by the regional force with troops from Benin, Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Nigeria, the Islamist jihadists maintain strongholds in areas that are difficult to access.
The U.S. House of Representatives has passed the Electrify Africa Act after nearly 2 years of trying to get the measure through both chambers of Congress. It now goes to President Barack Obama for his signature. The bill will provide a framework for a major public-private partnership between the United States and sub-Saharan African countries to help millions of people gain access to reliable electricity. VOA's Cindy Sain has the story.
House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Ed Royce said the Electrify Africa Act seeks to address the massive electricity shortage that impacts the everyday lives of millions of people.
It is a direct response to the fact that today 600 million people living in sub-Saharan Africa, that's 70% of the population, do not have access to reliable electricity.
Royce, a Republican, has worked with ranking Democratic member Elliot Engel and others to push the legislation through both the House and the Senate since 2014. The bill directs the president to establish a multi-year strategy to assist countries in sub-Saharan Africa in implementing national power strategies with a mix of energy solutions, including renewable energy sources. President Obama and the ambassadors from 35 African countries support the partnership. During a debate on the bill on the House floor Monday, members from both major political parties pointed out that without reliable electricity, millions of people in Africa cannot use tools necessary for modern life, such as lights at night, cell phones, and computers. They cannot refrigerate foods or medicines. Royce said the lack of electricity drives some families in sub-Saharan Africa to use charcoal and other toxic fuels, which cause more deaths than HIV/AIDS and malaria combined. Royce also said the high cost of energy in sub-Saharan Africa make producing goods for export almost impossible, and that is in the United States' own interest to help Africa become one of the world's greatest trading partners. Democratic Representative Brendan Boyle agreed.
Mr. Speaker, sometimes the right thing to do is also in our strategic interests as a country.
The bill passed in the Senate late last year and will now go to the president, who is expected to sign it quickly. In 2013, Obama outlined a Power Africa initiative, which aims to grant first-time access to electricity to 50 million people by the year 2020. The Electrify Africa Act should help make that goal a reality by providing a framework for companies to invest in promoting energy solutions in Africa without costing U.S. taxpayer dollars. Cindy Sain, VOA News on Capitol Hill.
A two-week campaign is underway that calls on people to do acts of kindness for women living with HIV. It's called Love Positive Women, a global campaign that culminates on Valentine's Day. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The UN estimates there are 16 million women living with HIV around the world. It is the leading cause of death among women of reproductive age. In 2013, About 60% of all new infections among young people occurred in adolescent girls and young women. In sub-Saharan Africa, nearly 60% of HIV-positive adults are women. The figure is nearly 50% in the Caribbean and about 40% in North Africa and the Middle East. The international community of women living with HIV says those women deserve a little kindness and recognition. It's behind the social media-driven campaign called Love Positive Women. It uses Facebook and Twitter to spread the word and announce Love Positive Women events. There were 84 such projects around the world last year. Jessica Whitbread is the organization's community relations and mobilization manager.
Love Positive Women is a global holiday that started 4 years ago in 2012, and it's a way to create space for women living with HIV. So if you're a woman living with HIV, how are you going to love yourself and make yourself feel good? And if you're a community member, ally, partner, child, how are you going to make the women living with HIV know that they're cared for?
More than 35 years into the epidemic, HIV-positive women still face stigma and discrimination.
Many women living with HIV experience increased violence in their homes and in their community due to gender inequality. These inequalities on a large scale, whether it be through employment rights, economic rights, social rights, those tend to decrease for women living with HIV. And maternal mortality increases for women living with HIV. Women living with HIV experience more stigma in healthcare settings, and often due to this, don't go back for services.
Whitbread says response to the grassroots campaign has been good.
Right now we have a Facebook filter. I'm looking at it right now. Many, many people are using it to show their support for women living with HIV. There is a very active Facebook page where people post their events and actions for the year and their ways of doing interventions for the women in their lives. It's been incredible. Just based on last year, tens of thousands of people were involved, and I can only imagine how many were impacted by that.
She expects this year's Love Positive Women campaign to be much larger than last year's.
One of the really special things that is happening is led by CZ Charity and the International Community of Women Living with HIV in India, and they are going to be organizing a TV show for Love Positive Women in India. And what's going to happen is they are bringing women to share their stories, and then a celebrity is going to come, and Indian pop star, and she's going to sing some songs as a surprise to all those women.
Campaign events include HIV-positive women working with artists in New York City to create greeting cards, or visiting HIV-positive women in prison in Zimbabwe. The ICW calls on the public to post a statement on Facebook, Twitter, or blog, and simply say something kind. For more information, you can go to icwglobal.org. That's icwglobal.org. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
New York City's Department of Health and Mental Hygiene is the largest municipal health department in the United States. And given the fact that 40% of the city's population was born abroad, it's no surprise that a significant portion of its work involves reaching out to many immigrant communities. New York City Health Commissioner Dr. Mary Travis Bassett recently held a press conference for the ethnic and community-based media. It covered subjects ranging from the Zika virus to food safety, mental health, and obesity. Afterward, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Dr. Bassett. He asked her about her department's approach to New York's burgeoning African diaspora community.
The main way in which we've interacted with the African diaspora, which is mostly from West Africa and New York City, was around the Ebola concerns last year. And that was something where our main concern was that we not stigmatize the African community. Of course, people coming from Africa, people who visit Africa, have to be concerned about diseases like malaria. But here in this country, it's the same things that we all worry about. It's heart disease, stroke, that are important to that community.
Interesting that you mentioned stigma, because I know that there's sort of a cultural difference in how, for example, HIV/AIDS is viewed and therefore the amount of treatment that is actually accessed between Africa or many African countries and here. So I'm wondering how you bridge that divide and how much different cultural issues inform your view and strategy as health commissioner.
Well, it's really important that we talk to people in ways that that they'll be able to understand, that's respectful of their culture and is, to use a sort of hackneyed phrase, is culturally competent. And that's one of the reasons that we want to have conversations like we have today and reach out to ethnic and community media that has a following and can convey messages to the community. They're a trusted messenger. You know, the HIV epidemic on the African continent is the largest epidemic in the world. Only in Africa did we see a generalized population HIV epidemic. And, of course, people come here and are diagnosed with HIV here and are treated here. And that is absolutely something that is important to the health of the public and the health of the individuals. So I don't think that the problem of stigma and shame around HIV is limited to any one continent. It's been a problem that everybody living with HIV has had to confront, and one which, as health commissioner, I'm really determined that we help make it clear that we can treat HIV, that people can live long and healthy lives. And the more successfully we treat you, the less likely you will be to transmit to somebody else.
You mentioned about we always think about sort of our expertise and our knowledge going from, call it the developed world to the developing world. But I was intrigued by what you have to say about the wisdom,
bringing
the ideas the other way. I mean, you mentioned community health workers and all that. What about that?
Well, it's, you know, this is a global city. New York City has 40% of its population thereabouts is born in another country. And so I think it's completely fitting that we turn to other countries and get some of their pioneering ideas and try them here. That includes technology, the use of mobile phones and so on. It includes people like community health workers. I was in Zimbabwe, which adopted community health worker model even before independence. And we know that community health workers can speak the language of people who they interact with. And it's really important that we promote people's ability to maintain their health outside of the clinic. And that's what community health workers do.
And that's what you did in Africa?
I worked on huge numbers of community health worker campaigns. You know, sometimes people think of them as health worker extenders, but I think of them as playing an important role in linking communities to health services and public health. And it's something we can learn from here in the United States.
That was Dr. Mary Travis Bassett of the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene speaking with VOA reporter Adam Phillips in New York.
In U.S. politics, Senator Ted Cruz defeated billionaire Donald Trump in Iowa's Republican caucus yesterday, while former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders ended the Democratic contest in a tie. Cruz, a conservative lawmaker from Texas, finished with 28% of the vote. That is 3.5 points better than Trump, the national frontrunner. Florida Senator Marco Rubio finished with 23%, making him easily the leader among establishment Republican candidates. On the Democratic side, the race appeared too close to call. With 94% of votes counted, Clinton led Sanders by just 0.2 percentage points. The results provided the first concrete look at voter sentiment after a year of fierce presidential campaigning.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Yisroel in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOAAfrica.com.
Visit VOAAfrica.com and subscribe to our podcast service.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Burundi's government denies the existence of mass graves. Islamic State militants are said to be building an army of the poor in Libya, recruiting soldiers from Chad, Mali, and Sudan. Coming up, music from Algeria. And in our feature segment, producing high-quality food in South Africa. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuheib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are starting off with African football.
Kim, joining us once again on the sunny side of sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sonny.
David, the field is now set for the semifinals at the 4th African Nations Championship Tournament in Rwanda. In the first semifinal on Wednesday, the 2009 CHAN champion, the Democratic Republic of Congo, will go against Guinea in Rwanda's capital, Kigali. Your thoughts?
Well, Sonny, I've been hesitant recently with forecasts because there have been so many surprises and even some shocks with the likes of Nigeria and Morocco failing to make the quarterfinal stage. But I've got renewed confidence about these semifinals, and I'm certainly thinking that Democratic Republic of Congo will succeed. I think they'll be too good for Guinea. As mentioned, DR Congo, winners in 2009 of the maiden CHAN tournament. In subsequent tournaments in 2011 and 2014, they went out to the quarterfinal stage, and they were involved in a great quarterfinal against Rwanda. The Congolese took an early lead. The Rwandans equalized in the second half. It went to extra time, and then with 7 minutes left from a cross, the Congolese headed what proved to be the winner. But it took a lot for the Congolese to succeed. They were up against 30,000 Rwandans, as well as the 11 on the field. To win in Kigali against Rwanda was a really good performance. Guinea, on the other hand, it went all the way to penalties against Zambia, 120 goalless minutes, and Guinea eventually emerging 5-4 winners on penalties. A rather interesting finish, Sonny, in that Abdul Aziz Keita, the Guinea goalkeeper and captain, he saved a penalty, so the score was 4-4 after 13 penalties. And then Keita himself decided to step up and take one, and he hammered the ball into the net to make it 5-4 and take Guinea into the last four. Shades there of the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations final when, of course, Barry, the Ivory Coast goalkeeper, saved a penalty and then stepped up and took the decisive one. DR Congo, nevertheless, I think they've got lots of scoring options. Of the 10 goals they've scored so far in the CHAN, 9 different players have contributed. Now, on the one side, you can say, well, where is there a leading goal scorer, somebody who's banging them in regularly? They don't have that. But on the other hand, it just shows you the potential in this team that 9 different players are capable of scoring. Guinea play nice football, a short passing game, and they've already done extremely well. To beat Nigeria 1-0 and qualify for the quarterfinals was most unexpected. They showed great fighting spirit in other group games, twice coming from behind against Tunisia to draw 2-2, twice coming from behind against Niger to also draw 2-2, and then really slugging it out with the Zambians in the last quarterfinal. We cannot underestimate them, Sonny, but with a reasonable degree of confidence, I'm going for Democratic Republic of Congo to win on Wednesday afternoon, 1400 hours GMT, and qualify for the final.
And now let's turn to Thursday's semifinal, David. Mali will meet Ivory Coast, also in Kigali. How do you see that match?
This one, Sonny, I see Ivory Coast winning. Again, perhaps I'm being too brave for my own good, but I'm really confident about this Ivory Coast side. They just got better and better as the tournament went on. If we rewind quickly, they started with a 1-0 defeat by Rwanda. A little bit unlucky. They stuck the post right at the end and were probably worthy of a draw in that game. In their second game, they shaded Morocco 1-0. A goal from the penalty spot, but the Ivorians were clearly the better team. And then they really came to life in their third match against Gabon, which was basically a fight for the second quarterfinal spot from Group A. The Ivorians led, the Gabonese equalized, and then the Ivorians hit three unanswered goals for a very decisive 4-1 victory. On to the quarterfinals, they faced up against Cameroon. No goals during the 90 minutes, and then the Ivorians took command to score three goals. And the last of them, Sonny, from their captain, Serge Yao Nguessan, was the goal so far of the tournament, and there have been 71 goals. He took the ball out of defence, and while still in the centre circle, he looked up, spotted that the Cameroon goalkeeper and captain, Patrick Nyam, had strayed slightly off his line. And from the centre circle, he unleashed a shot which flew into the net. Superb goal, wonder goal in my opinion, and definitely so far the goal of the 2-16 Chan. That made it 3-0, perhaps a slightly flattering winning margin, but nevertheless, this was a Cameroon side that in two Chan tournaments had never lost and had only conceded one goal previously, and now here they were conceding three goals just in extra time. So you've got to say that the Ivorians are very much a team on the rise. No star names. Of course, there's no Yaya Toure or Didier Drogba, who's now retired. There's no Wilfried Bonnet. This is very much the local stars. But they play well as a team, and I like the fact that they've been consistently improving as the tournament went on. Mali, a surprise packet, very similar to Guinea, not a team one at the start of the tournament would have imagined being in the semi-finals. They've been battlers more than anything else. They drew 2-2 with Uganda, edged Zimbabwe 1-0, drew 0-0 with Zambia in their final match to finish second in Group D. And then in the quarterfinals, they were all at sea in the early stages against Tunisia and fell behind after 14 minutes. But Tunisia couldn't get that second goal, which I believe would have put the match beyond the reach of the Malians. And as so often happens, the Malians equalized with 20 minutes left. And then the momentum switched very much to the West Africans. And it came as no real surprise when Abdoulaye Diarra, who was named the man of the match, scored the winning goal in 10 minutes from time. Interesting, Sonny, that three of the four semi-finalists are from West Africa. No West African team has won this tournament. In 2009, it was Central Africa via the DR Congo. And subsequently, Tunisia and Libya have won for North Africa. Now we find an all-West Africa semi-final between Ivory Coast and Mali, and in the other half of the draw, we got Guinea taking on DR Congo. Another really interesting fact to me was the fact the four group runners-up won the four quarterfinals. Not a single group winner emerged victorious. Cameroon, for example, beating DR Congo, but now they're out. Tunisia emerging on top of Group C, which was the group of death, but they're now out. So we've got a very strong West African flavor, and it's all the teams that finished second in the groups that are in the semi-finals. So once again, Sonny, emphasizing I'm sticking my neck out here, I'm going for a DRC versus Ivory Coast final on Sunday in Kigali, and that will mean that the third-place match will be the curtain raiser to the final at the Amahoro Stadium, will be between Guinea and Mali.
Thanks for sticking your neck out again, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg. Saudi Arabian female athletes say sports are on the front line of breaking traditions that squash women's voices. In their hometown of Jeddah, one group of basketball players says by connecting sports to health issues, they're encouraging women and girls to get out of their homes and participate in public life. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Jeddah.
One of the richest countries in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia is in many ways as modern as any place on earth in terms of infrastructure and conveniences. But activists say the kingdom has a long way to go in terms of women's rights. In the coastal city Jeddah, Activists say by encouraging women and girls to play basketball and other sports, they promote health and chip away at the image of Saudi women as virtually silent members of their society. Wearing white uniforms with long pants and Islamic headscarves, the Jeddah United women's team plays an exhibition game in Malaysia. Officials say by playing internationally, Saudi women broaden their own horizons, as well as those of the nations they visit. This is Lina Al-Maina, who heads the Jeddah United Sports Company.
We played in the United States, in Malaysia, in Jordan, and the UAE, as well as Riyadh and other cities in Saudi Arabia. So we do that locally to promote sports and internationally to also try to change stereotypes and show a different segment in Saudi Arabia.
At a charity event in Jeddah promoting sports for handicapped boys and girls, female basketball players say women's sports are increasingly popular at home and there is a wait list to get on their team. Player Noor Gary says defying stereotypes in Saudi Arabia requires pushing boundaries without breaking them. Men do not attend games, and players only allow cameras in when they are fully covered. But she says many people do not approve.
And it's not even against the law or against the religion. It's just people having their own beliefs and trying to close it on other people. So, yeah, being open towards sports means that they have more flexibility towards other things.
Players say women's rights in Saudi Arabia have come far in recent years, but many basic freedoms, like the right to drive cars, remain elusive. Last year, women in Saudi Arabia voted for the first time, and 20 women were voted into local office. Like politicians, female athletes say they believe women's sports will eventually be accepted more publicly. This is Jeddah United coach Deborah Parkwood.
We have some great athletes here in Saudi Arabia. Some of the girls that really, they want to play harder, they want to train harder, and they would love to compete for their country internationally.
In the meantime, players say promoting women's sports locally is having an immediate impact on society, showing women the benefits of exercise for themselves and for their children. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Jeddah, Saudi Arabia.
Thanks, Heather. And for those female basketball players in Jeddah, you go, girls, nothing but net. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. You'll see photos and videos, and you can post your comments. And my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. Once again, my Twitter handle, @VOA Sunny Sports. Tweet, tweet, tweet. I'm VOA Sunny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sunny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America. Well, many small farmers in South Africa are abandoning the use of expensive chemicals to aid their food production. They're trying to capture a growing consumer market that wants ethically produced healthy food. It's not a new kind of farming. Some South Africans have been doing it for years. In the second part of our series on people producing high-quality food in South Africa, Darren Taylor reports on one of the pioneers of organic farming.
Elizabeth Ames says as soon as she saw this land in the Hekpoort Valley in South Africa's northwest province more than 50 years ago, she knew she had her farm. The terrain is rugged and rocky, just like the 80-year-old herself, with her tough, mottled skin and no-nonsense approach.
I had no idea what the farm was to be or to become. I knew that I was not prepared to use artificial fertilizers or poisons.
Ames studied agriculture at college and started Weleda Dairy Farm in the 1960s, at a time when women in formal agriculture were rare worldwide. She's always been dedicated to producing fine dairy products naturally. She doesn't give her Jersey cows any growth stimulants or antibiotics and never sprays her land with pesticides. The farmer's animals are free range, grazing on natural high-felt grass all day, sheltered in spacious barns at night. Ames pours milk into a container to make cream. Her farm produces a variety of products, from milk to cheese to yogurt, containing no preservatives.
And there is nothing in these things that anybody would be allergic to other than lactose.
An electronic system of suction valves removes milk from cows' udders and deposits it in large transparent tanks. Ames says her cows produce small amounts of milk because she doesn't do anything artificial to them, as she puts it.
Cows can have things implanted in their ears, hormones, which will increase the production. And that means that on the same amount of food, they will give you far more milk. That means it is economically more viable.
But, says Ames, she's into the ethical production of high-quality dairy, not into farming to get rich. She says she loves her cows and calls them her children. She's named every one of them.
Well, May has just calved a little girl, and her name is June. And Sun had Moon, and now they've had a daughter. One of them has calved, and she will be Venus. Well, they're just my family. They're just my family.
Ames says she mourned a long time a few years ago when stock thieves stole one of her animals and butchered it in a neighbouring settlement. Weleda farm workers monitor big silver pumps channeling milk inside a shed. Ames has a strong relationship with her employees. She's built houses for them. She almost adopted one, a Mozambican, as her son, after authorities threatened to deport him. But Ames is a tough taskmaster.
I do expect them to be punctual. And if they aren't, they lose money. One of them came to complain to me that last week he lost 50 rand. And I said, yes, that's because you were late. And I said, and today it's 20 past six. You were not here at six. The cow should be here at six. So you're going to lose it again.
The way Ames runs her farm and treats her animals results in excellent dairy products. One of her biggest fans is the manager of Fresh Earth Organic Food Store in Johannesburg. Andre Brown sells Weleda Farms butter, cheese and yogurt.
We've been stocking Elizabeth's stuff from Weleda for quite some time, and there's a reason why we'll keep on stocking her stuff. As Elizabeth is quite scrupulous if it comes to her product. She's a very proud woman. She's a very nice Buritani. She doesn't deviate from her philosophy about what she's doing with her product.
Successful though Ames is, it's never easy for her on the farm. She's survived a few attacks on her by criminals. Once, three men broke into her house at night and threw her out of bed, demanding money.
One of them sat on me, bruised my ribs, and hurt the upper skin of my right hand.
What are all these stains on the carpet? Is that from your blood?
Yes, from blood. Handy Andy is the best for removing blood.
On another occasion, armed robbers shot into her bedroom while she was asleep. Sunlight dapples onto her bed through several holes in her curtains. Her wall is pockmarked.
I wasn't even so much afraid of the shots, but the breaking glass was very noisy. You can see up top where they hit. That was the third one. The fourth one would have hit me in bed, but I managed to get out of bed and into the bathroom where I could find my shorts.
So these are bullet holes?
Those are bullet holes, yes.
A thunderstorm unleashes welcome rain on Ames's parched land. She has plenty of reasons to give up farming, from violence against her to looming drought to financial struggles. But Ames says she's never considered quitting.
The reason why I do it is because I'm a farmer. There's nothing else I can do. I mean, I have, every now and then I've got to do things like write invoices. And I'll always be counted on to make a mistake. And I'm only here because I love to be here. I have planted every tree. I have put in every fence.
This love, she says, is more powerful than any fear inside her. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in the Hekpoort Valley, South Africa.
The United Nations says cancer is a leading cause of death worldwide, accounting for 8.2 million deaths in 2012. The Cancer Association of Zimbabwe is urging everyone to get yearly cancer screenings. The association joins some hospitals and government agencies to offer cancer screenings to detect cancer and offer early treatment. The Cancer Association will also join the Health Ministry to commemorate World Cancer Day tomorrow. Junior Mavu of the Cancer Association of Zimbabwe speaks with VOA's marvelous Malanga Nyahuwe about tackling cervical cancer.
World Cancer Day preparations are going on well. This year, the Cancer Association and many other stakeholders have come together with the Ministry of Health and Child Care. The celebrations will be done in Mutare. Preparations are underway for this day to be commemorated in Mutare. So all these stakeholders will also be participating on that same day.
When you look at the different cancers that are affecting people in Zimbabwe, which ones would you say are the most common?
In females, cervical cancer is the most common cancer, followed by breast. In men, it's the prostate cancer that's leading.
What are you urging people to do should they suspect that they have some sort of cancer or just to remain vigilant?
I think people shouldn't wait for them to have symptoms so that they can be checked. I think we should make it a habit that every year people are screened for just a general body physical examination. This is where some of these issues are picked up. And also things like cervical cancer, prostate cancer, people can visit their nearest clinic and get themselves checked.
When you look at the statistics in the country regarding cancer, would you say there's been an increase or a decrease of cancer cases in the country?
There has been an increase, and the reasons for the increase could be, as a country, we are now reporting on all the cancer cases that are out there, and then the number suddenly goes up, or people are also suffering from cancer. Remember, cancer can also affect people whose immune system is compromised. So I can safely say these are some of the reasons why we have high figures of cancer.
When we look at the actual detection of cancer itself, where is it offered and is it for free or what are the charges like?
Most of it is free. If you look at the municipality clinics, they are offering most of these services for free. The public institutions are also offering these tests for free. A few private institutions are charging. For example, Cancer Association, we do have a fee for cervical cancer because we are a non-profit-making organization. So if we charge, this is how we then replenish whatever we use in testing people.
Take us through the preparations, like when someone comes in for cervical cancer examination. A lot of women seem to have this stigma that it's very evasive. But how can you allay their fears?
I think the VIAC process, that program that's being offered, is a friendly procedure. It doesn't take time. You get your results there and there. If there's a problem, you're also treated during the same visit. So if people want to know more about it, they can still visit us, and we can take them through the process before we even have the test done on them.
Where can they find you? Where are your offices?
Our offices are at number 60, Livingston Avenue in Harare, opposite the Zifa House. Our offices, our number is 707-444-707-444. That's our office number. And we are open from Monday to Friday, 8 to 4:30.
That was Junior Mabu of the Cancer Association of Zimbabwe speaking with VOA's marvelous Malanga Nyahuwe from Harare. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. government, through the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, transferred the recently completed construction of the National Health Laboratory in Kampala to the Ministry of Health in mid-January. U.S. Mission Uganda's Chargé d'Affaires Trish Mahoney and Minister of State Chris Bariomunsi presided over the handover ceremony. The National Health Laboratory project began in 2012 when the Ministry of Health requested the assistance of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, to support the construction of a laboratory to address critical gaps in Uganda's health service delivery system. Funding for the National Health Laboratory construction came from CDC and the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. Construction began in 2013, and the more than $8 million facility is now completed and has been transferred to the Ministry of Health. The National Health Laboratory will play a key role in strengthening Uganda's health systems by providing a valuable resource for the detection, control, and ongoing surveillance of the diseases which affect the health of all Ugandans and influence Uganda's sustainable development. While the priority of this new facility will be HIV diagnosis, prevention of mother-to-child transmission of HIV, and viral load monitoring capacity, those suffering from many other health conditions will also benefit from this lab. The ministry's sickle cell and hepatitis B virus screening and the World Health Organization-supported meningitis, cholera, and typhoid screening program will make use of this facility. The National Health Laboratory could also be used for confirming bacterial disease outbreaks and for diagnosing malaria. This building represents our partnership with the people of Uganda and our commitment to helping Uganda build its future, said Chargé d'Affaires Trish Mahoney. We will continue to work with the government of Uganda and the Ministry of Health in the coming years to strengthen Uganda's health infrastructure and ensure it becomes strong, efficient, and self-sustaining.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Today on Health Chat, host Lenor Modu discusses Zika virus. What is it? Who is at risk? How to prevent and treat it? Understanding Zika virus and the current outbreak. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Else chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC. Right here on VOA Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the African Union Summit Year of Human Rights with a particular focus on women's rights. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests next Wednesday at 1830 UTC as they discuss human rights. That's next time on VOA Africa.
VOA News. VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.